Please help me welcome Professor Evans.
Okay. Well, I made a few promises in the last couple lectures. Hopefully we'll live up to them in the evidence tonight. I love doing this lecture for more than one reason. I believe it presents possibly the strongest material for the resurrection, but it does it in an easily, I hope, easily memorizable form. It's got a lot of factual points to it, but nothing's difficult. And I hope that you'll be able to take it. And I've delivered this lecture, strangely enough, in Oxford. I've delivered it in Cambridge. I've delivered it in major schools all over, but I've also delivered it to sixth grade, what would that be, 11 and 12 year old children. And I hear people say, well, listen, I've listened to your lecture several times, and I did it for my Sunday school class. Now, that's an honor to me, because I think the material here is applicable to these other venues, but it does not suffer at all, I don't think, from being less than the best material today. In fact, when I was giving this lecture in Cambridge once, Richard Baucom, whose name I've used often this weekend, as well known as any New Testament professor, Cambridge professor, came in and sat in the back of the group. And I thought, great, I'm going to go ahead and give the same lecture. But I mentioned him several times in this lecture, and now he's going to be sitting right here, and he can tell me later whether I've taken his name in vain, you know. And after it was over, he was very pleased. And so I thought, okay, well, that passes the test if Richard Baucom was sitting there. So what I'm going to do, we've got a PowerPoint that'll help you. If you like PowerPoints, it will help you, if you like to read the lesson and follow that way. But I'm going to be walking a timeline this whole evening. And if you'll bear with me at the beginning, there is a point where I'm going to walk in front of the projector and go over to the far wall. And once I come back, I won't be doing that again. So what I'm going to do tonight is start down here. I'm going to call this creation down here. This is 2013, way down there. And this right here, this point, I'm going to allow to stand for the crucifixion of Jesus. Most New Testament scholars date this event at about, at 30 AD. The next popular year, you might wonder, well, why not 31? But you have to get the full moon and Passover and things lined up. So the next most popular year is 33. But because it's just irrelevant trying to solve that issue, I'm just going to call this ground zero. And because we're talking history, I'm going to be marching to and from this point, and I'll be using plus minus figures. So it's plus minus from 30 AD. How far are we? And so on. Now, we gave a lecture this morning, the first lecture, where we talked about criterion and the New Testament. And two of the most important things that we did right up front are early and eyewitness. Anytime you talk about history, you're talking about, hopefully, early and eyewitness data. But in the ancient world, it's often rare to get early and eyewitness data. But if you ask the average Christian, if this is ground zero and Jesus died, what's the typical argument? Now, in a way, we went over this today, because first lecture, I began with a top-down argument, and then I went immediately to a bottom-up argument. We talked about the bricks for the rest of the message, for those of you who are here. Well, I'm going to give what the top-down argument looks like on the resurrection, and then I'm going to let that argument go. I think it works fine to use both arguments together. Nothing wrong with, you don't have to pick one or the other. But once I give you a quick outline of what that argument looks like with the Gospels, I'm going to use the rest of the argument based on Paul, and more about why I do that when we get there. If you ask the average Christian who studies apologetics, what is the usual approach that is used for justifying the resurrection, you frequently will get this top-down angle that I mentioned this morning, which starts with the Gospels. And it will go something like this. And I'm going to be using critical dating instead of evangelical dating. It's not that much difference. There's really no difference on Mark at all, and no difference on John. But Matthew and Luke are a few years late. It doesn't make any difference whatsoever. I do this because my methodology, recall, is to use data which are shared by everybody. And it is shared because it is so well evidenced. Okay. So, here's ground zero. Jesus dies. And if you ask the average Christian, apologetics starts looking like this by the first method. The average Christian says, well, let's use the book of Mark from 65 to 75, or, to use what I just outlined a moment ago, plus 35 to plus 45. At just 35 to 45 years after ground zero, we have Mark's account of details of the death of Jesus, crucifixion, burial, empty tomb, angels, and the predicted appearances, and so on. Matthew from about 80 or plus 50. Luke from about 85 or plus 55. And everybody puts John at about 95. This is the latest of the Gospels, and it's only plus 65. So if this is as bad as it gets, I mean, as far as time distance, we know we're on pretty good grounds, because this is just 65 years. And you may have remembered that when Bart Ehrman, in his book, Did Jesus Exist?, when he lists what facts we could know about Jesus, he lists 100 years. He says he thinks that's a fair period of time in which to look at sources. 100 years. So even at John, which the critics delight in telling us is the latest of the Gospels, is still 35 years short of that 100-year marker that Bart Ehrman uses. And many authors go to 150 or something like that. So these are, as far as years are concerned, they're good sources. And oftentimes, evangelicals and a few others have argued that we can know the authorship of these four books. And if they're not written by apostles or eyewitnesses, they at least were in a position to be affected by that kind of research, as Luke tells us himself in Luke 1:1-4. Now, I point out that in the ancient world, many ancient figures are not blessed with this kind of information. And time again, we have to rely on information which is much later than this. And although our early sources for Alexander, there were a lot of earlier sources for Alexander the Great, contemporaries even, but we don't have the works anymore. They may turn up someday, but we don't have them now. And the works for Alexander go from about 300, plus 300 years after Alexander, to the high point of about 450. And the best two books that tell us about Alexander, that help us the most, are Arian in Plutarch, both at about 120 AD, which if you add the 330 BC for Alexander, that's going to be about 4.5 centuries after Alexander died. Now, it's true. We have other little pieces of archaeology and inscriptions from Alexander, but I mean, if you talk about a piece of work similar to a gospel, similar to a lengthy tract that tells us something about him, it's 400 to 450 years later. So Alexander, if that's just Alexander's death down there, we're going to be way outside this wall to be talking about our earliest detailed sources for Alexander. And so why somebody would tell us that we can know a lot of things about Alexander, as I had an atheist tell me in a debate about a year ago, we could know a lot of things about Alexander, and in the same 10 minutes, he said the Gospels are too far away from the cross to be helpful. Now, why this double standard of too many years away at 35 to 65 years, but Alexander's nice at 400 to 450? And you might say, that's because the Gospels record miracles. Well, let me make a couple quick responses. So do almost every Greco-Roman history in the ancient world. Now, you might say, well, so much the worse for Greco-Roman histories, because we don't allow miracles. Now, I don't have time. I didn't do this lecture today, so I've been doing one around Sweden on this topic. But it might just be mentioned, given some of the documented sources today, and the pastor here shared one last night that happened right here in this church. They're well known. In fact, if you want to know about present miracles, I suggest that you take a look at Craig Keener's two-volume work, simply entitled Miracles, published by Baker Academic. And there are hundreds of miracle, actually it's thousands of miracle claims are reported. And many of them, besides being quite bombastic, have pre and post x-rays, CAT scans, and MRIs. So you can check it out. The only thing I'm saying is this. You don't eliminate the Gospels from consideration just because the Gospels report miracles. Actually, you could argue that the Gospels report fewer miracles than other secular sources. And what if I told you of all four of these Gospels, John records the fewest number of miracles? We often get the idea that the story keeps getting larger and larger as time goes on, but John records the fewest number of miracles. And then my other point is, if miracles are going on today, yeah, the Gospels are looking pretty good at plus 35 to plus 65. Okay, that's the first method that I outlined this morning. But I'm going to do a second method now, the brick method, based on the writings of the Apostle Paul. Won't be using the Gospels from here on out. Why do I use Paul? I use Paul because Paul is the skeptic's darling. Critics love Paul. Why? Well, because a lot of critical scholars don't think we can know the authors of the Gospels. That's another matter. But they will concede that of the 13 books that bear Paul's name, seven of them, at least seven, are what they call, what Bart Ehrman calls, the authentic Pauline epistles. And you can find this in any introduction to New Testament, no matter how critical the source is. We have the authentic Pauline epistles. And when they say the authentic Pauline epistles, don't get the idea that somebody grants these three and these two and these, and somebody else grants these three and these two, and they agree on which books they are. And here's the books that are accepted as authentic writings of Paul. Romans, 1 and 2 Corinthians, Galatians, Philippians, we have 1 Thessalonians, and of course the short book, one chapter, non-theological book, Philemon. Now of these main books that bear Paul's name that critics accept, what do they think of Paul? Well, critics aren't going to argue that Paul is an errant or something like that. But they're going to say that Paul is an authority. He was a scholar. Just look at his argumentation of the book of Romans, and you could tell, as Anthony Flew said, even in his atheist days, Anthony Flew said, Paul is a first-class philosophical mind. So he's been well-trained. We know who the author is. He's very early, because Paul's epistles largely date from just about 20 to 25 years after the death of Christ. At least they begin to be written then. 20 to 25 years after the death of Christ. They predate the Gospels. So if Mark is going to be over here, one of the two books I'm going to use tonight from Paul is 10 years earlier, approximately, maybe 20 years earlier, and that's 1 Corinthians. And so critics think Paul, one more thing about Paul, he was in the right place at the right time. He knew the right people. Now, whether he knew Jesus or not before the crucifixion, that's an open matter. We don't know. But he said he met the risen Jesus on the way to Damascus, and for sure, Paul says he spent time with the apostles, the major apostles, as we'll see, in Jerusalem very, very shortly after Jesus died. So here's how we get these conclusions. Paul is writing 1 Corinthians 15, and in the first two verses, he says, I came to you, Corinthians, and I presented the words of the gospel. Now, informational footnote. Whenever the gospel is defined in the New Testament, and in particular, these are in the epistles of Paul and in the sermon summaries in the book of Acts, we get this. This is God's side of the plan of salvation, let's say, and then there's the response that we're asked to make, that Paul himself says, you know, what did you do with this material? But here's the side that God ordains as the gospel. Always mentioned are the deity, death, and resurrection of Jesus. Minimum. Deity, death, resurrection. Now, sometimes other things are mentioned. Sometimes burial. Once Paul says, born of a woman. So I take it he's contrasting Son of God, deity, with born of a woman. Sort of a Philippians 2 kind of kenosis kind of idea. But the three that are always present, deity, death, resurrection. Resurrection's at the center. And in 1 Corinthians 15, 1 and 2, Paul says, I came to Corinth, I presented the gospel to you, and here's the other side of the gospel. Paul says, whatever you did with it determines whether or not you're a believer. He says, if you received it, he uses the word saved, he says you're saved. If not, you're not. That's simple. Did you respond? And that word belief, by the way, in the New Testament, the words for belief, pistis, pistuo, the words mean they involve a commitment. It's not believing like, you know, my favorite soccer player's name is, or this is the name of, I believe the name here, or I remember, I believe this date in my country's history. It's not that kind of belief. It's belief as in, well, I really think the closest example might be marriage, where we say, I do, to somebody. And we make a commitment. The New Testament talks about saying yes. And so Paul says, what did you do with the gospel? Did you respond properly? Good. If you didn't, well, then you're not a believer, he says. Then in verse 3, he says this. I gave you what I was given. I delivered to you what I received. Now these are simple, but very profound words. I gave you what I was given. I won't be able to explain this. It's a lot of New Testament research behind this. But if there's a conclusion in New Testament research that's very, very strong, it is that Paul is repeating a creedal statement. Other synonyms would be formula, tradition, a confession. Paul is repeating a statement here that is pre-Pauline. We talked about the Jesus seminar today. Very, very skeptical. They reject 80 to 90% of the so-called red letter words of Jesus. They reject just, you know, the vast majority. And yet the Jesus seminar acknowledges that these words are pre-Pauline. What's pre-Pauline mean? Well, let's take a look. Here's ground zero, Jesus' crucifixion. When does Paul come to the Lord? Some people say 1 year. I guess what I'm asking is, how close is Acts chapter 9 to Acts chapter 1? Could be a year. Could be 2 years. Might be 3 years. Let's use an average. Plus two. Jesus dies. Paul says he met the risen Jesus at plus two. Pre-Pauline means if Paul received this material back here, that's what we're going to argue. This material predates Paul's conversion. So, as strong as our conclusion is or can be that we can use the Gospels and down to John, as strong as that could be, potentially Paul is repeating material that is from right here, from here to here, that early. And remember the criteria we gave this morning. Earlier is better in general, An eyewitness is better than not. So, in chapter 3, in verse 3, Paul tells us, 15:3, 1 Corinthians, Paul says, I gave you what I was given as of first importance. I gave you what I was given as of first importance. That's an amazing comment. I gave you what I received as central in the Christian faith. Now wait a minute. He wrote this about 55 or plus 25. But he said, this is what I gave when I came to see you in Corinth. Oh, well, this is when he wrote it. But when he came to Corinth, some have said this is the most readily ascertainable date in the New Testament. Because Paul came to Corinth in 51 to 52 AD. We can tell because we know who was, it's mentioned in the New Testament, the man's name who was city controller at that time. And from an inscription in a rock, from an inscription, archaeological inscription, they know when this fella came to power. And, you know, just conveniently, all of these town rulers had a reign of 1 year. And he was in power from 51 to 52 AD. So Paul says in 55, this is what I gave you when I came to you. He came approximately 4 years earlier in 51 to 52. And here he says it there, but he said, this is what I gave you. I gave you what I received from somebody else. Okay, if this is pre-Pauline, and if he received it from somebody else, when and from whom did he receive this? Now keep in mind, we're working toward early eyewitnesses. And to have both of those two together would be an incredible help in reconstructing ancient historical events. Okay, early eyewitnesses. The consensus New Testament position, according to Richard Bauckham, the consensus New Testament position is that Paul received this material about 35 AD. Maybe 35 is there. About 35 AD. You say, how do you know that? Well, let's let Paul do the math for us. Remember, Paul's trustworthy, good thinker, well schooled, he's honest, he's authoritarian, he was at the right time, right place with the right people. He's the best person around to give us this material. What does he tell us? He tells us, last of all, same passage, last of all, he appeared to me, 1 Corinthians 15:8. In 1 Corinthians 9:1, he says, am I not an apostle? Have I not seen the Lord? And this is dated, as we said, let's take an average, at about plus 2. Now, flipping over from 1 Corinthians 15 to Galatians chapter 1, Paul says in Galatians 1, he says, the Lord revealed himself to me, and I didn't go running up to Jerusalem to see those who were apostles before me. He's trying to establish that he did not receive the call to be an apostle by human beings. He received the call from the Lord himself. And so, I didn't go running right up to Jerusalem. I spent 3 years in Arabia, and then I went to Jerusalem. Okay, there's our math. Paul comes to the Lord approximately plus 2. Again, how close is Acts 9 to Acts 1? Paul comes at about plus 2. He says 3 years later, I went up to Jerusalem. 2 plus 3, 5. If you think he was converted fairly late at, say, plus 3, now it's simply plus 6. So he's up in Jerusalem at about 35 or 36 AD, maybe 34 if he was converted at the 1 year mark. And he's up there very early. And Galatians chapter 1, he says, I went up to Jerusalem and I saw no apostles. He said, I stayed there for 15 days. And the only apostles I saw were Peter and James, the brother of our Lord. Peter and James, the brother of our Lord. Now, if you were Paul, what question would you pose to Peter or to James? I know what my question would be. Now, the book of Galatians, it's a short book, and it's on one subject, the gospel. What is it? Don't wear it out. Preach it the right way. Don't make it bigger than it is. Don't make it less than it is. Preach the right gospel. Anything else is anathema. Galatians is about coming to God on God's terms. Gospel. Paul could not have been with Peter and James for 15 days and not mention the nature of the gospel. But Paul's going to tell us in a moment that's exactly, it was the center of their discussion. But for now, he talks to them. And here's what have been my question if I was Paul. I would have said, I'll tell you gentlemen what I saw on the road to Damascus. If you tell me what you saw immediately after the death of Jesus. And don't get me wrong. I've persecuted the Church of Christ. I don't deserve to be called an apostle. I don't deserve it at all. But you know, Paul was kind of bold. In all honesty, fellows, Peter, you denied your Lord. I mean, how was it to see him again? James, I understand you weren't a believer when your brother was home and afterwards. And you met the risen Jesus. How did this contribute? How did this, you know, lead to your faith? Tell me about the risen Jesus. And I think he would have asked them that, talked about the nature of the gospel. And since the gospel message is indispensable, and since it includes the resurrection of Jesus, it would have happened right here, I believe. Now, as Galatians 1 ends, just a few verses, and we get into Galatians 2, here's how Galatians 2 starts. There's no chapter dividing in the original. And Paul says, Galatians 2:2, one of the most outstanding verses in Scripture. He says, Paul says, I went up to Jerusalem 14 years later. Okay? 14 years later. Scholars usually put this in about 48 AD or plus 18. Still very early. And he said, I went back up to Jerusalem, Galatians 2:2, and I set before the apostles the gospel I was preaching to see if I was running or had run in vain. You go, what? Yeah, I went back up to Jerusalem at plus 18 to see if we were all on the same page. I wanted to make sure the other apostles and I were preaching the same message. And you might say, took you a long time to get there to confirm the message, didn't it? I think Paul would say, you know, you're not doing a really good job of understanding my argument. Here's my argument. I got it from the Lord. Are you okay with my source? Okay, thought so. 3 years later, I got it from Peter and James. You okay with that? Okay, good source. This is at least the third time I've checked my message out. Now, a lot of scholars think that Acts 15 and Galatians 2 are the same visit to Jerusalem. Some think it's another visit to Jerusalem by Paul. Some think it's the same one. If it's a different visit, Paul made 3 trips to Jerusalem in order to make sure they were all on the same page concerning the Gospels. If it's the same as Galatians 2, well, then we have backup. Remember this morning, independent sources? We would have a backup for this second trip in Galatians 2. But Paul goes up there, and guess who's there this time? Peter, the chief apostle, James, the brother of the Lord, the pastor of the church at Jerusalem, and now John is there. Now, the reason this is significant is I don't think we can name 4 more influential Christians in the early church. I don't think we can name 4 more influential Christians than Peter, Paul, James, the brother of Jesus, and John. The most influential believers. And Paul says in verse 2, Galatians 2, verse 2, I set before them the gospel I was preaching. And just a few verses later, he says these words, 5 words in English. Just a few verses later, they added nothing to me. They added nothing to me. What's that mean? We're on the same page. Paul's on the same page with Peter, with James, with John. And by the way, we talked a little bit today in the second lecture about the importance of martyrdom, because martyrdom doesn't prove a message is true, but martyrdom shows that you believe the message to be true. And of these four individuals, Peter, Paul, James, and John, we have first century sources for the martyrdom of Peter, Paul, and James. And Christians frequently say, you've probably heard this a fair amount, that John did not die as a martyr. He's the only one of the 12 that didn't die. Matthias taking Judas's place. Everybody else died as a martyr. But guess what? We have a second century source for John's martyrdom. So we have a first century source. Good historiography here. First century source for the martyrdoms of Peter, Paul, James, second century source for John, most influential early believers. We have them all right here, and Paul says, they added nothing to me. Now, let's keep moving forward with this message. They're all on the same page. Galatians chapter 2 is there affirming Paul, that Paul and the others are on the same page. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 11, right after that early creedal passage, which goes back to the 30s, right after that, 1 Corinthians 15, 11, we have Paul commenting on them. See where I'm going? They comment on Paul and say Paul's okay in Galatians 2. Now, Paul comments on them, and here's what we read. He just got done talking about the apostles seeing the risen Jesus. And then here's what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, 11. Whether it is I or they, so we preach and so you believe. One more time. Whether it's I or they, so we preach and so you believe. What Paul's saying is, hey, listen, I don't care if you get it from me. I don't care if you get it from them. You're going to hear the same message. Whether it is I or they, this is what we preach, and this is what you believe. And in the next few verses, Paul says several times, we. What's his point? The other apostles and I. The other apostles and I. We're on the same page. We're teaching the same gospel. Bart Ehrman, of all people, if you haven't heard our earlier presentation, I love to use Bart Ehrman. He's an agnostic. He's not a Christian. He says that clearly. He says he's an agnostic leaning toward atheism, not a believer, and yet he's going to give us some really useful information. He's an honest skeptic. He's fair as a skeptic. And here's what he says about this visit to Jerusalem. He says, first of all, he says Peter spent 15 days in Jerusalem. And then Bart Ehrman says, I'd like to spend 15 days with Peter and Jerusalem, Peter and James. I'd like to spend 15 days. And then he asked this question, where do we get closer to eyewitness testimony than this? Where do we get closer to eyewitness testimony than this? Remember the first two rules on the criterion? Early in eyewitness, what does Bart Ehrman say? He got it from them right after the cross, and this is as close to eyewitness testimony as we get. What do we get? Early eyewitness. And we're getting there the way critics get there, because we're using the sources that they allow because they meet the historical test. They meet the test. Now, let's see if we can do a little better than 35 AD. Now, it's easy to miss the point, but this isn't the date of the material. This is the date Paul heard the material. I'm sure he heard that Jesus appeared to his apostles, but this could very well have been the first time Paul heard the apostles give their own testimony. Paul hears it. This is when Paul got the material. But watch, if Peter and James gave it to Paul, which is the most common critical view, they had it before he did, right? If Peter and James gave this testimony to Paul, they had the testimony before Paul did. And in the New Testament, these creeds often read in kind of a staccato kind of fashion. New Testament critics think often that there's two stanzas in 1 Corinthians 15, 3 to 7, and in the Greek it's something like da 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 da. Two stanzas. It's stylized. Now here's my point. Paul hears it. They had it before Paul. And it takes a while to turn the testimony into a creedal passage. It would be like saying you're working with somebody on a song, and it takes a little while to get the notes and the music just where you want it, to do it in a da-da-da-da-da fashion. So Paul hears it. They had it before him because it's their testimony, and it took a while to get it in this fashion. Now, this is a very recent development in New Testament studies. But let's mention Larry Hurtado, recently retired from University of Edinburgh, Scotland. Richard Baucom, from still at Cambridge, as far as I know, Cambridge University. And James D.G. Dunn is as influential a name as there is in historical Jesus studies today, recently retired from Durham in Northern England. And these three researchers who are the heads. They're the main researchers in what happened in the earliest church between this period and this period. And these three New Testament scholars say that coming out of the gate in 30-ish AD, coming out of the gate in 30 AD, we have to have two sermon points, let's call them, two messages, or you don't have Christianity. You have to have these two. Now, first of all, let me tell you, a lot of critics, up until just recently, think that the New Testament, being a normal historical book, when people hear something bombastic, like Jesus is Son of God, he's deity, we talked at length about that today with the criteria, some scholars think that it takes a long time for people to understand, to unpack, to understand exactly what it means, say in Philippians 2, about the kenosis passage, remember, he was in the form of God. And by the way, the Greek word form, morphe, the word morphe, in English at least, it usually means an outline of something, a form. But morphe in Greek usually means nature. So in this early creedal passage in Philippians 2, Paul says Jesus was in the morphe of God, nature of God. Next verse, he was in the morphe of a servant. We call this the kenosis passage. The nature of God, nature of a servant. Philippians would date a little later for Paul, so it takes a while for people to unpack this, people think. And some have thought that you have to get down to John before they fully unpack the meaning of what Jesus taught about himself. In fact, the dean of American New Testament scholars, until he passed away in the 1990s, Raymond Brown, said... He said, if Jesus had returned in 100 AD and read the Gospel of John, he would have said, that's where I was going. That's where I was going. It takes a while for that to sink in. Now that's flip-flopped. And a lot of scholars, including Dunn, including Baucom, as far as I know, having talked to them a while back, they've changed their positions. And they believe that coming out of the gate in 30 AD, you have to have two beliefs from the very beginning or you have no Christianity. Number one, high Christology. It did not take until 90 or 100 to unpack the deity of Christ. They had to have it right here. How do you define high Christology? Here's Larry Hurtado of Edinburgh. High Christology, he's got a number of levels and meanings. He's an excellent writer, as is Richard Baucom. And Hurtado, by the way, is a specialist on this question. If you're interested, you get his large 500-page book called Lord Jesus Christ that gives his research on this for 25 years, specializing in the early church. And he says, here's how you know the early church had a high Christology. They worshiped Jesus from the get-go. They worshiped Jesus in the very beginning. Now, here's the problem. Monotheistic, law-abiding Jews It's all about God, it's all about God, it's all about God, and we're worshiping Jesus. How does that work? In fact, in 1 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 6, an amazing thing happens in an early creed. Paul quotes, or paraphrases, the Shema, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one." And it seems to break it up, "The Lord your God is one." And he uses God for the Father, and he uses Lord for Jesus. Check it out, it's really something. 1 Corinthians 8, 6. "Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one, and his Son is Lord." And the discussion is, this is unimaginable. Did Paul just bring Jesus into the Shema? Now, I mean, I shouldn't say did Paul. This is pre-Pauline. This is before Paul. It's another one of those pre-Pauline creeds. "Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is what? One, and Jesus is Lord." Right there. So, as Hurtado says, we know it's a high Christology because Jesus was worshipped. How do you get any higher than that? And here's Richard Baucom. Richard Baucom's main emphasis is the earliest Christians used Old Testament words for God, the chief of which is Jehovah, and they applied those words to Jesus. I can't think of two more bombastic things than worshiping Jesus and applying words like Jehovah to Jesus. And how do we know that? Because another creed, Romans 10:9, I think probably most of you know it, "If we confess with our mouth that Jesus is Lord and believe in our heart that God's raised him from the dead, you'll be saved. If we confess with our mouth that Jesus is Lord and believe in our heart that God has raised him, we'll be saved." Now, if we believe with our heart that Jesus is Lord, the Lord can have a lot of meanings. What does Paul mean? It's pre-Pauline, but what does Paul mean by Lord? So Romans 10, 9 and 10. Just three verses later, Paul says, he quotes Joel in the Old Testament, and he says, "Whoever calls upon the name of the Lord will be saved." But guess what? Lord in Joel is Jehovah. Whoa. That's heavy. I mean, that's really special. If you confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God's raised him from the dead, what are you doing? You're calling on the name of the Lord. Joel says whoever calls the name of the Lord will be saved, but Lord is Jehovah, because when the Old Testament was translated into Greek, we call this Septuagint, when the Old Testament is translated into Greek, Lord is the translation for the holiest name for God. And when it shows up in Romans 10, 9 and 10, it's as if Paul's saying, confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord. And here's what I mean by Lord. Call upon the name of the Lord, Jehovah. So Hurtado and Baucom are saying, and Jimmy Dunn, James Dunn, they're saying that coming out of the gate, right here at the beginning, we have a very high Christology. The second belief we need, the resurrection. Hurtado says, for example, if there ever was a time when Jesus wasn't raised, the church is without its message. So two messages had to be here at the beginning: a high Christology and a resurrection of Jesus. How soon? Right here. Right here, pre-Pauline. And James Dunn, as influential a scholar as there is in the New Testament today, James Dunn says one of the most radical things that I'm aware of. He says, remember I told you it took a while for the creed in 1 Corinthians 15, it took a while for any of the creeds to come out in a da-da-da-da-da fashion. James D.G. Dunn says this is such a central creed. He said it could not have been more than just a few months after the cross when that came out. Jesus dies. We have the 1 Corinthians 15 creed, well, I went way too far there, months later. Peter and James preach it. Paul hears it. And that's the gospel. We're all on the same page. And as Paul says, they added nothing to me. Or, as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15:11, where there's I are they, so we preach and so you believe. They say, well, no, wait a minute. When you talked today and you did your minimal facts, you made the point that you used the data that critical scholars are willing to use. Yes, I did. Where are Baucom and Hurtado? They're fairly conservative, but they're very influential. How about Dunn? He's not so conservative, but he's very well accepted. He is as big a name as anybody, and he says months. Well, how about a skeptic? Are they going to agree with you on this dating? Bart Ehrman. Let's go to Bart Ehrman. The agnostic leaning toward atheism, who may be the, quote, hottest of the skeptics today. Most of his books are published by Oxford. He's a very well-known scholar. And Bart Ehrman says, many of our earliest sources, such as the Acts Sermon Summaries, now we haven't had time to talk about this, it's an exciting topic, but the Acts Sermon Summaries are mostly found in Acts 1 through 5 and 10, those are Petrine, and Acts 13 and 17, those are Pauline, and they're the very early accounts, the earliest accounts we have of what this early preaching sounded like. And Bart Ehrman says, a number of those go back to the 30s AD in Acts. And a number of the creeds go back to the 30s AD. Really? Bart Ehrman, the skeptic? 30s AD? Exactly. In fact, twice in his book, Did Jesus Exist? He says it goes back to the 30s, probably 10 times. I mean, he's not shy. And twice he says, probably within 1 to 2 years. The best known of the skeptics, this material goes back 1 to 2 years after the cross. What did we start with this morning? Early an eyewitness is the way to start an ancient historical discussion. If we have early eyewitness material for Jesus, we're on a foot that we do not often have with Greco-Roman studies. We don't often have that foot to put forward, that kind of approach, that kind of benefit. But with the early Christian sources, we can get the teaching of the gospel. If Jimmy Dunn is right, months. If Bart Ehrman is right, it's no worse than 1 to 2 years. And in ancient historiography, it doesn't get much better than that. Now let me answer one last question, and I'll be done. All right, what this shows is that the earliest disciples believed they saw the risen Jesus. Correct. In fact, that's almost unanimously admitted by New Testament critics today, no matter how skeptical they are. The earliest disciples believed they saw the risen Jesus. Okay, here's the big question. How do you get from thought they saw Jesus to really saw Jesus? How do you take that last step? Thought they saw Jesus to really saw Jesus. All right, here's what I'm going to suggest. We have excellent, excellent data for they thought they saw the risen Jesus. The next thing you do is what we did this afternoon. If you apply skeptical questions and you say, well, how do we know this didn't happen? How do we know that didn't happen? Are we sure of this? Are we sure of that? And if you can answer all the critical questions, here's the way it would look in a kind of a quasi-mathematical equation. My apologies, Ola, a real mathematician. This isn't math, but it's a quasi-mathematical equation. The earliest disciples thought they saw the risen Jesus, plus the naturalistic theories fail, equal the earliest disciples saw the risen Jesus. Or let's say it a different way. If the earliest disciples were utterly convinced they saw the risen Jesus, and no other conclusion can explain that, then our best conclusion, as historians might call it, the inference to the best explanation, is that the earliest disciples did see the risen Jesus. I don't care how often I give this message, I get excited. Because this is the key to the gospel. This is the gospel. And they're all on the same page. Paul preached it, Peter preached it, James preached it, John preached it, Peter died for it, Paul died for it, James died for it, and John probably died for it. That means they were utterly convinced. And guess what? Of anybody in history, they're the best ones to be utterly convinced because they were there. They would know if they did or not. And their word was, I'm willing to die for it. I'm willing to die for it. Folks, there's no better message in the world. Because as the gospel goes, so the truth of Christianity goes. And I'll leave this thought with you tonight. Our young people go away to secular schools. I doubt it's any different in Sweden than it does in the U.S. It might be worse in Sweden. I don't know. But our reports are that when young people go away to secular schools, this is their self-report, 60 to 90% of them say they walk away from their faith in secular schools. Now, there's a lot of reasons for that. But I think one is we misidentify what we have to know, what we have to be sure of. And many times people pick at the peripheries of the Christian faith. They pick at this, they pick at that. And all you got to do is look at some of the major publishers and the Four Views books and the Five Views books. Christians don't agree on things like sign gifts. Christians don't agree on sovereignty, free will. Christians don't agree as to whether we should worship congregational low church or high church in a wonderful building like this. We don't agree. There's a lot of give and take. Paul says, don't judge your neighbor. Let everybody be persuaded. We don't agree with all these periphery things, but we do have to make a stand for the gospel, the deity, death, resurrection of Jesus. And if our young people could only understand that if Christ was the Son of God who died on the cross, who was raised from the dead, that's Christianity. It's not all there is to Christianity. It's not all there is, but it's the center. And as long as it's true, the Christian faith is true. And as far as evidence, tell me something in the ancient world that's better evidenced. We have this on good grounds. The disciples were utterly convinced they saw the risen Jesus. Naturalistic theories don't work, as we saw earlier today. Conclusion, the disciples really did see the risen Jesus.